at length last time. Maral carves out his position and he says like this. There are those who say, right, no less than the Rambam, but the Maral does not quote him as such, that really this verse has absolutely nothing to do with the prohibition. Here, there's a seat right here, Yudley. Hot seat. Yeah. The verse has nothing to do with the prohibition. Absolutely nothing. The verse is not talking about forbidden things which are cooked by non-Jews. It doesn't say it. Right? It says they're going to buy water and they're going to buy food. So it's fine. However, the thing is, the rabbi said, you know, it's not a good idea. They're going to socialize too much. So therefore, don't buy it. But they didn't want to just leave it dangling there in the air as if you're going to need a new text. You know, yeah, the Torah laws need a new text of rabbinic laws. So they said, you know what, as something that within the Chumash, when you learn the Chumash, you'll be able to remember that there's such a thing as this prohibition, so we'll pin it on this verse. But it's nothing to do with the actual intention of the verse on any level whatsoever. That's what the Rambam says in his introduction to the Perush HaMishnah. And the Maral has some very choice words about this Rambam. He says, absolutely not, it's impossible, he views it as some form of heresy. It's not only the Maral who says this, that, but we showed you the opposite extreme in the Ritva. The Ritva in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, Daf Tazayin, says very, very negative words against such a position. And the Ritva says, no, the opposite is the case. The idea is that the Torah is indeed, when it gives an asmachta, it's not so clear. Because the Torah is not clearly and absolutely forbidding it. But what the Torah is doing is, it's giving you a hint, a tease. It's telling you this idea, it's hinting to you this idea, not coming right out and saying it, because it wanted to leave it for the sages to uncover it and to legislate it. But the Torah is actually giving you this guidance. Again, it's not as directly, not as clearly. That was the Ritva's position. The Maral took a median position, which we saw, and he did a few examples, and we'll just use this one which we have brought. The Maral says, no. It is a rabbinic invention. The law is a rabbinic invention. And it's not that the Torah said it, but, you know, didn't say it clearly. It's a rabbinic invention. However, when the rabbis did it, they didn't just say, you know what, we think it's a bad idea because eating this kind of food will bring to socialization. They looked in the Torah, and they read in the Torah this kind of a thing. They found in the Torah that eating leads to socialization, and it would not be a normal way for people who are different, separate, distinct, and indeed very, very cagey about each other to eat these kinds of foods together. In other words, when the Torah says that the Jews said to them, you'll sell us food and you'll sell us water, the Torah is not saying, we want you to know it's forbidden to sell food and water. No. But what the Torah is saying is, look, this is what the Jewish people proposed, food and water. Water is the simplest of beverages. So they were also probably talking about the simplest of foods. Not because it was forbidden, but because here the Jewish people are coming and proposing to them, you know, this is sort of like an arm's length thing. You don't want to get entangled with us. We don't want to get entangled with you either. We're just proposing, just let us go through and then you'll never hear from us again. So when they said it, and they wanted to save their benefit, and they said, you know what, and we're not even going to ask you to cook for us gourmet meals that we're even going to buy from you. We're just going to, you know, if we buy anything from you so that it's good, it'll be good for your economy, we'll just buy basics, staples, raw materials. And that was the way the Jewish people proposed non-entanglement. You know, you won't have to worry about us. So says the Maral, so the sages said, oh, what do you see? You see that when you want it, when you are have more of a relationship, but you are more entangled, one of the signs of that, or one of the means of that, is you cook for each other. You have a potluck. Whatever it is, you know, you get together around some, you know, some nice cooked food, some favorite dishes. Says the Maral, so the sages picked up from that nuance in the Torah that this is a bridge of socialization, and therefore they said, now that we want to legislate to create safeguards about socialization, this is the bridge which we're going to address. They got it from the Torah, not that the Torah was prohibiting it. That's what the asmachta, according to the Maral. And the idea is that when the sages made things up, they showed you that they were, their thinking was very, very much developed by the Torah. We talked last week a little bit about how this relates to the concept which is used of Das Torah, where you go to someone, to a great sage, and you ask him a question, and it's not necessarily a halachic question. Tell me what it says, what's the Jewish law about this? But you ask the person how to approach a situation, or what the opinion would be about this. The person's not going to tell you this is the halacha, it's permitted or it's forbidden, or you must do this or you must do that. But because they have spent so much of their life and have absorbed so much Torah, they pick up these nuances of how the Torah thinks about things, how the Torah views things. And then they're able to apply it to this situation. According to the Maharal, that's the concept of asmachta. The nuances that the sages picked up in the Torah's discussion that could serve as the conceptual basis for their legislation, for their creations of halachos. That's what we talked about last time, and we will go on if there are no questions on this express train. Hashlishis. Okay, in the version of in the Hartman version, it's letter Beis in Be'er HaRishon. Hashlishi, the third category. Now, excuse me. When I said before the Asmachta, he counts it as a second category, but in many ways it's not really a difference of opinion. Because everything which has an Asmachta has to fit into one of the other categories. Okay, so let's say this case over here. The sages legislated you can't eat with them. They based it on a nuance in the Pasuk, but they were coming to do what? They were coming to protect the limitation against intermarriage. Jews have to be careful in their social circles because we have the ultimate relationship, the ultimate social relationship, which is marriage, is very, very limited. It's limited to being amongst Jews. And therefore, the sages created a safeguard. What we learned just now was that the sages picked up what the safeguard should be from nuances in the Torah. But ultimately, the piece of legislation was there as a safeguard. And that's the third category, which again really is the second. It's not interpretation of the Torah, it's a creation. And a creation for what purpose? A creation as a geder, as a safeguard, as what we call in Pirkei Avos, siyog la-Torah, a fence around the Torah. What's the concept of a fence around the Torah? Why is it something which, if it should exist, is left for the sages to create? Okay, the first question is an easy question. The second question is a more difficult question. The first question is, what is a fence around the Torah? So look, it's simple. It's and clear, and you would have this really, in a sense, in any set of rules, where this is the problem. And however, we know that if this is the problem, you want to be careful to avoid it. So therefore, you might establish for yourself additional safeguards, additional issues, so that it won't be involved. What would be wrong with a child in school, right, having a beeper? Yeah, what happens if there's some very important thing which he has to get from his parents have to contact him for something rather important? But on the other hand, the thing is that beepers, maybe this is a little bit dated, right? But beepers became associated with drug business, right? So therefore, they said no beepers. Right? No cell phones, no face, I don't know, GPS devices. Whatever it is. The idea, putting some kind of a safeguard in place so that one will not avoid this kind of a thing. Person's not supposed to eat this food. It's very, very, it's unhealthy for them to eat this specific food or to, let's say, eat a lot of it, so they're gonna put up a safeguard and they're gonna avoid places where they serve it. They're going to avoid partaking of it at all, because once you have one, you end up having a few more than one. Safeguards are something that we always establish in our lives. However, if such a safeguard needed to be in place for Torah law, it becomes an interesting question and a difficult question. If it needed to be in place for a Torah law, why didn't God tell us? Why didn't God tell us to avoid it? I'm sorry?
No, it's a step from the beginning.
Right. It should have been there in place. Okay. Now, the Maharal first says something as a beautiful comparison to the notion of the thing, the object, and its safeguard. And the Maharal says like this. There's a comparison, which some of you may be familiar with, of the mitzvahs to the parts of the body. You know that there are 613 commandments. The Gemara says there are 613 mitzvahs in the Torah. Of those 613, 248 are mitzvahs asei, positive commandments, mandates, and 365 are mitzvahs los asei, are prohibitions, restrictions. The Gemara says that the 365, the Gemara says, correspond to the 365 days of the year. In other sources, it says that 365 correspond to the ligaments, the sinews that exist in the body, holding it together. But the 248, the Gemara itself says, corresponds to 248 evorim, 248 limbs, 248 parts of the body. Now this is a comparison which is a very open comparison, which in a different context we can talk about, you know, elements of it. What's the idea? You know, the Zohar says you have 248 limbs in the body and they're all integral, right? You don't just get rid of one of them without there being a cost, without there being a difficulty. And that's the idea. The Torah is not just, you know, a grab bag, pull out a few and do them if you can. But there is something to the whole system. While, of course, any one you do is terrific, and in fact we say one mitzvah leads to the other, that's indeed because one mitzvah leads to the other, because the system is an integrated system. So every buy-in to the system continues and builds and adds your connection within the system. But it's an integrated whole, like a body is an integrated whole. Maharal, however, right, besides for whatever other meanings may exist, Maharal says, look at this. So you have 248 limbs in the body. The limbs of the body come with protection. The limbs are protected. They're not there. They're not exposed. The body has its own systems to protect them. Classic example is our eyes, which are evarim. So we have eyelids that are able to close them, that are able to moisten them. That, right, okay, Dr. Elman will be happy to add different functions of the eyelid. But there's a shmira, a protective system, which is there for the Aver. And says to Mara, look, just like the Avarim, the limbs, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us these limbs, very, very important gifts with which we function, and Hashem gave them to us, and He also gave us something to preserve them. So too He gave us the mitzvahs, and we also have to have things to preserve them. But then, that which preserves them should also have been given to us. I mean, didn't Hashem give us the eyelids? Right? So why didn't Hashem give us the eyelids, the protectors, for the mitzvah as well? So, the Maharal, I'm going to read to you a few words here of the Maharal, which are difficult to understand at first glance, and we're going to try and discuss them and understand them better. Ubevadai ha'evorim vitzurasan hupulas Hashem Yisbarach. Certainly the limbs and their shape are the creation of Hashem. And this should be attributed to Hashem more than attributing it to sort of a creation of nature. Whereas the protection for the eye, she shmiras ha'ayin, which is there again, the covering of the eye, which is there to protect the eye, Yesh liyaches ze yoser el hateva. This should be more associated with not God's creation, but nature. Kach gufa mitzvah, Seder Hashem Yisborach, I'm just reading this, okay, we're going to discuss it in a moment. So too, the body of the mitzvah, Seder Hashem Yisborach, the mitzvah itself, Hashem put in place. Rak shmiras ha-mitzvah, just maintaining the mitzvah, protecting the mitzvah, that's a mitzvah de Rabbanon, that is not the direct creation of Hashem, that Hashem gave over to the sages. Dovar ze gozru upalu chachamim. That's people. That is like ascribing it to nature. Hashem put them in place that they should then create it. Again, the words the Maharal says is the eye should be called the creation of Hashem. The eyelid is sort of a natural protection that is there in order to protect it. The mitzvah itself is the creation of Hashem. The protection of the mitzvah is sort of a natural protection that we would be able to create in order to address it. Now, the difficulty in that statement, of course, is very, very obvious. What, nature created eyelids? Hashem didn't create eyelids? When Hashem said, let me create man, so then, you know, the eyelid was not part of that function. Right, so some might listen to this maral and hear in this, you know, echoes of some kind of a theory that people develop those things, or beings in creation develop those things that allow them to survive. Right, go to the aquarium, right? You have the day off, go to the aquarium and go and study the fish and see the patterns on the skin of the fish, on the scales of the fish, and see how they adapt and they are disappearing into the seabed or something, in terms of being able to see them and notice them. These are survival mechanisms that perhaps developed after the fact in order to make them exist until this very day, but not the creation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This maral sounds in a certain degree like he might be saying something like that. And you know something? At the risk of being grossly misunderstood, but because I trust all of you so immensely, that you won't, let's think a little bit about what that says. Let's think a little bit about what that says. Not again to suggest things that would need to be off the charts, but to understand within. And I'm going and let's think about it this way. Hamechadesh betuvo b'chol yom tamid maasei bereishis. We daven shachris. I assume most of us daven already. Hamechadesh betuvo b'chol yom tamid maasei bereishis. God renews. We say in the first blessing of what we call the blessings of Kriyat Shema. The first blessing after Baruch Hu in the morning is a blessing about nature. We specifically, of course, focus on the night-daytime issues of nature. The light during the day, the darkness at night. We do this at Shachris and at Maariv, both times when we say Kriyat Shema. The first blessing is about God's creation of nature. The second one is about God's development of his specific connection and relationship with the Jewish people. Bocher ba'amo Yisrael, bi'ava ohev amo Yisrael. In the bracha about nature in the morning, we conclude and we say, Hamechadesh betuva b'chol yom tamid maasei bereishis. God renews with his goodness every day, constantly, maasei bereishis, creation. As it says, ka'amur, and we cite a verse, li'oseh orim gedolim ki li'olam chasdo. In the Halel HaGadol, in that psalm which we say on Shabbos morning with the two columns, right? This, ki li'olam chasdo, this, ki li'olam chasdo, this, he did this because his kindness is eternal, and so on. One of the lines is, the one who makes the great luminaries in the heavens because his kindness is eternal. Says what the prayer is saying is that it doesn't say she'osa orim gedolim, who made the great luminaries in the sky, that he made them 5,700 and whatever years ago, but it says he makes them in the present tense. That means that this moment that the sun is shining, he's being mechadesh, he's renewing the creation, he's making it exist. creation does not exist because it was created then. It exists because it's being renewed instant to instant, moment to moment, right now. That's what we say in our prayers each day when we thank God about creation. So, the question is, what is the significance of the moment of creation? What's the significance of the 6 days of creation? The 6 days of creation is different than now. Hashem is making the lights now. On the fourth day, Hashem said, "Let the He put in the heavens, the sun and the moon and the stars." He did that right now. He put in the heavens, the sun and the moon and the stars. And now He did it again. And now again. Right? So what is the significance of the 6 days of creation?
The start.
The
start of it.
It's the start of it all.
Establishment is, the maintenance is much easier in a sense than the establishment.
Okay, you heard that word? The maintenance is different than the establishment. I just want to bring out the point a little bit. He has a whole different explanation, a mimer, but Rav Yitzchak Kuttner in one of his mamorim in Shabbos asks the following profound question. We keep Shabbos because 6 days Hashem created the world and on the seventh day He rested. Says the Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, but I thought Hashem renews creation every instant. So it means Hashem's creating the world again on Shabbos. So He's not resting. He's continuing, you know, to create it, to make it happen. What's the difference? Rav Kuttner has a whole different approach to answer that question than what we're talking about now. But what's the simple answer to that question? Is that essentially what you have now is maintenance. What you have now is Shmira. The preservation of the creation. The creation was initiated, it was made, and now this is how it will remain. This is how it will be preserved. This is how it will continue. That is different. Whether you're going to say it that on the 6 days of creation is when Hashem created the patterns, the frameworks through which the world would continue to function over time. But as much as we might say that Hashem is maintaining every moment, and it's almost like an illusion, the existence of the Bria. But in another way, there is some kind of meaning to that illusion. When Hashem creates these structures have something to them, in the very least, in somehow Hashem removing His obvious connection to it. When you were there, if you could have been there, if anybody could have been there at the moments of creation, and suddenly, poof, for the very first time, there's light, and there's a sky, and there are plants, so then you say, whoa, 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 what, who did that? Right? There's the Ribbono Shel Olam. Hashem's very, very clear, very, very visible. This didn't just come out of nowhere. But now, we say, oh, how's this here? This was here a minute ago. Where were you? Mm-hmm. Right? Right? There is... It maintains itself. There's a sense that it maintains itself. There's no yesh me'ayin. There's no something from nothing. But remember, yesh me'ayin, ex nihilo, was only also in the first day of creation. Bereish is bara. Beria is yesh me'ayin. After that, Hashem formed and changed and developed. But even then, it was visible. Once He created the patterns... So Hashem, in a certain degree, is stepping back and letting the world maintain itself. Maintenance is a term for the Hebrew word shmira. Well, kiyum, yes, you're right. Kiyum is to maintain it, that it will continue to exist. But we would also say to keep that which is already there is to be shomer, to safeguard it. That it shouldn't blow up, it shouldn't disappear, it shouldn't be gone.
Which the Greeks deny.
That Hashem has a role in that.
He
created and abdicated. And that's it. He doesn't need to. It's like, you know, the Ford Motor Company, right, creates the car, and then it's yours, right? You want to bring it back for service. So then you could bring it back for service. The Greeks question whether you could even bring it back for service. Really, you know, is whether Hashem will ever respond. But you buy it, you roll it out of the showroom, right? And then, you know, found on road dead, right? Isn't that what it stands for? That's what they say? Uh-huh. I'm sorry. Not the other.
Although you occasionally push a fork.
So there is a stark difference between the boom of creating something and then the maintenance of it. And the maintenance of it, to a certain degree, once you've been given it, once you've been delivered, part of the message, part of the idea is now it's yours to keep it. It's yours to safeguard it. Of course I want you to keep it. Of course I want you to safeguard it. But you have to do that. Now, in our example here of the car, so they create it and they give it to you, and then they give you a nice thick manual. And they may tell you, you know, this is the way that you're going to be able to keep this and preserve this as well as possible. It probably doesn't say in the manual, please avoid driving this thing into brick walls. Right? To a certain degree, there is a shmira that it's understood, the protection, the pride, which is yours, and it's yours to do, and it's your responsibility to make sure that it happens. The preservation, says the Maharal, is more ascribed to teva, to nature. Whether you're going to call it, oh, everything is created with a basic and fundamental survival instinct. And that's, some would say, the most basic instinct that a human being has. That they're going to find a way to ensure that they will keep themselves going. But again, that's it. To be shomer, once you're given it, it's yours to protect. So much so that profoundly it would be said that a person's most basic instinct is to protect the gift of life or the gift of existence that they have been given. It's now yours. That's not necessarily as directly from Hashem. So, of course, we will still say, Adam HaRishon was born. Hashem created him with eyelids. It's not something that, you know, necessarily, that the Maharal is arguing in chronology. He was created and then he did eyelids. But you know something? Let's say a person was born without eyelids. What would he do? He'd make them. If a person, le'aleinu rachmana litzlan, has a serious cut on their skin, so you know there's a problem, you know, because the skin is a shomer. It's a protector. It protects. One of the most significant organs in the body. I don't know if it's counted in the 248 of Chazal, but it's called an organ, right? In science, I think they call the skin an organ, and it's there to protect. You know, if your skin is covered, so Bezras Hashem, there is no port of entry for the infection here or whatever else it is. A person gets a cut. What do? They create artificial skin. They put on a bandage. They're shomer, they preserve that which they have been given. Hashem created us with a lot of shemira, with a lot of protection. But Hashem, in that sense, did that work for us. But you know that then perhaps guided us as to how we would protect ourselves. Well, we know from the skin that it's good that this stuff is covered. When it becomes uncovered, so then we figure out, you know what, let's do it ourselves, let's cover it up ourselves. In a certain sense, Hashem did the same thing with Shemira of the mitzvahs. He told us, I want you to safeguard the mitzvahs. And he even sometimes perhaps gave us some kind of safeguards around it. Like, for instance, the Nazir, who's not supposed to drink wine. Right? The big no-no for the Nazir, you understand, is wine. Wine is a luxury, the intoxication, the everything which is involved in that. But on the other hand, the Torah says, he shouldn't eat grapes, he shouldn't eat grape pits, he shouldn't eat grape skins. Basically, the Torah is saying, as the Talmud says, schar schar l'karma l'sikrav. Don't even walk through the vineyard. The Torah is creating a model for build a skin around the mitzvahs. Protect the mitzvahs. Yes. And that's your job. The mitzvah is the gift from Hashem. The mitzvah is what Hashem brings to you direct. The protection is your responsibility. Idea?
Does going back to the physical example, the eye and the eyelid, does it have more to do with the inherent function of the object? I mean, the eyes themselves are a limb that perform mitzvos. They are the essential component in that they serve the ultimate purpose. Whereas the eyelid, in and of itself, the function isn't to perform a mitzvah. You don't perform the mitzvah with the eyelids. It's there to serve, to protect the limb that performs the mitzvah. So it's a function distinction then. When the Maharal says that we nature forms the eyelids, as you say, it's not chronological. It has to do with, it's a function distinction, right?
It's a functional distinction. The mitzvah is the mitzvah itself, pure, what is desired, what is wanted. The shmir is not purely what's desired, what's wanted. You know, really, we wish you could do without it. However, you need this in order to maintain that. So it serves that function of being a buffer zone or some of that. Right?
Yeah.
Right? That's what it is. Yet the question begs itself. If it's needed, why didn't Hashem tell us to do it? That's the issue which Maharal asked. Yes, there's clearly a difference between the actual desired action or item and those things which are necessary just in order to enable it to be there. But why, if you need to have these support systems, why is it left for us to create those support systems?
There's a better example.
That's why where you need this notion that the Maharal is at.
If he lived today, he'd probably have a different example, perhaps. But I'm going to allude to it in terms of the daris. Previous daris may have been in a higher madrega, and his daris has slipped. There's maybe a need for having more of a shmir, a siyad. We can have an example from that with the eyes themselves. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, there may not have been a need, I wasn't around, neither were we, to have safety glasses. But as time went on, we had people involved in the industry, there were many eye injuries that involved, and the powers that be said that you have to have these glasses to protect.
Eyelids don't do the trick. That's a very good example.
Or Rakabal, although they don't mandate it. But they should do it.
Technically, that's a rule.
The shoes they mandate, not the goggles. But the same type of concept. As circumstances changed, the need arose to have more protection that was not originally put in there. But the idea was still to protect the Ribbono Shel Olam's Bria.
Correct. Remember that one of the teachings of the Anshei Knesset Hagdola was Asus Yog LaTorah. The Anshei Knesset Hagdola, the men of the Great Assembly, the first really active legislative body that we attribute. I mean, again, there was legislation which came, new legislation which came from Moshe Rabbeinu, like Kriyas HaTorah, like Shlomo HaMelech, who created the Erevin, Netilas Yodayim, right? The Gemara attributes many generations of legislation, but if you would talk about the super legislature of the Jewish people, the one that created the davening that we just did in the form which we just did it, and so many other halachas, the bracha that I just made, was the Anshei Knesset Hagdolah, the men of the Great Assembly, which was the 120 member legislature that came in place at the beginning of the second Beis Hamikdash. So the Mishnah of Pirkei Avos begins, and it says, Moshe received this order from Sinai, gave it over to Yeshua, who gave it over to the elders, who gave it over to the Nevi'im, who gave it over to the Anshei Knesset Hagdolah. And they said three things, right? And one of the things which they said was, Asus Yog LaTorah, make these fences, make these safeguards around the Torah. So, as their era was an era of very, very noticeable slippage, because even though they were a great group, a great body, but once upon a time, the dominant feature in the Jewish people were prophets. And for them, once upon a time was, you know, in the lifetime of some of them, in fact, they still had a couple of the prophets left over. Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, the last three prophets, were members of the Anshei Knesset Hagdolah. But they knew that it was disappearing, that wasn't going to be there anymore. So things were changing. There was a major, major transition that was happening. So making those extra fences, extra protection, is necessary. Extra protection is needed. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more here as we go on to the next little piece, that a meaningful piece, but little piece of the Maharal. Yes.
So, is the implication of Dr. Ellman's observation true that at the time of the giving of the Torah, that no fence was necessary, that as of that generation, that generation was able to keep the Torah without fences, and that really it's just a function of the reduction of the generations, that as there was slippage, that's when fences were required, and therefore it's not until the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah that we get this teaching, make a fence for the Torah, the implication being as it becomes necessary to make fences, not that it's a proactive commandment that Hashem wants it, but rather as there's slippage and as it's required, then you should make fences according to the level that needs it.
Okay. Maharal here, in this essay, does not say that. However, it is a fact that the need to create fences did grow. Witness, again, the beginning of Pirkei Avos, Asus Siyag LaTorah. Like Michael's example, there is a development time where things become different and require it differently, and require a different reaction. And let's move to talk about that a little bit and see how that development, you know, perhaps would happen. Illustration. Hashem says to Noach, I want you to go into the Teva, into the ark, and into the ark I want you to bring animals. When it comes to the non-kosher animals, the behemah asher einena tora, the animals that aren't pure, those you should bring two of each, a male and a female. And when it comes to the ones that are kosher, you should bring shiva shiva ishvishtei, seven man and wife. Okay, great. What's a kosher animal?
Are you saying
what? How did Noach know what a kosher animal was? Rashi says, Mikan shalomad Noach Torah. From here we see that Noach learned the Torah. What does that mean, that Noach learned the Torah? What Torah? Okay, so the others knew the Torah too. So, you know, let me perhaps suggest to you, and you know, maybe to some of you, those of you who were here yesterday, you know, could relate it to what we talked about yesterday in shul. If you know, it's not a safe thing to drink kitchen cleanser, right? You know that? Okay. It's not a good idea, right? Everybody can agree to that. Okay. What happens when you drink kitchen cleanser? You take one drop and you spit it out. It's horrible. You know right away that you've done something terrible. It's not necessarily true of every poison. It's not necessarily true of every mixture which has in it a little bit of the poison. But you know, there is an instinctive, you know, let it go. If you have something that's not kosher, okay, now let's assume for a second that there's a reason why it's not kosher, okay, which we, I think, can fairly assume. It's not just that Hashem said, okay, these are my subjects, I want to make sure that they adhere, that they listen to me and they learn deference. I'm going to tell them, do this and don't do that. And that will show that they're deferential, even though I could have said, do that and don't do this. No. Hashem commanded us on these things because they're pure, because they had an essential condition. You wouldn't be able to tell. If Hashem said, these things you can eat because these things, they'll be good for you. Not healthy for you, but these things are not going to introduce into your system. After all, you are what you eat. These things are things that can be harnessed and used to develop you better and to raise you up as a human being. These things cannot. You can't tell.
If you're in a high enough level, roughly as well, you can tell you have 10 tons of life.
Exactly.
And you couldn't even eat animals.
Well, okay. You're right.
You look at two liquids, can you go?
When you look at them, so then it becomes harder to be able to tell.
But even on that level, you're saying that maybe even that
there's
a perception.
Something called being able to perceive, to be able to sense, to be able to see the quote-unquote metaphysical qualities of something, the things which are not just necessarily the three-dimensional, you know, properties, to be able to see them, to be able to sense them. An example of that, perhaps, the prime example would be a Navi. What's a Navi? A Navi is a person who visualizes, who's able to have, to be able to receive, right? We can all talk to the Rabbona Shalola. We can also talk to the walls. And if you talk, and if you come to somebody after they did both, they may feel exactly the same way, right? But you can't hear from a wall, right? So for us, we can't hear what the Rabbona Shalom is saying. A Navi was able to hear what the Rabbona Shalom was saying. He was able to hear what the Rabbona Shalom was saying. It's not an assumption. It's not necessarily going to be there all the time that a person's going to be able to discern that. In the generation of prophecy, what else did you have, for example? That is true. But they had in the Mikdash, in the temple, they had visible manifestations of the presence of Hashem. There was a cloud of Hashem's presence in the first temple. There were other visible things. You know what another visible thing, by the way, was? A simple one. The tablets that were inscribed by Hashem's hand. That was a visible way to be able to see Hashem's presence and Hashem's creation. What happened at the end of the first temple? The tablets were hidden away. The presence of Hashem was not visible in the second temple. It was not visible. It was not tangible at that point in time. Yes, we have 10 miracles which happened in the second Beis HaMikdash, according to the way most understand the 10 miracles happened in the Beis HaMikdash are described as happening even during the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. But the five elements which the Gemara in Yuma lists of Gilui Shechina, of the revelation, the obvious revelation of Hashem's presence, were lacking from the second temple. They weren't able to see things that once upon a time they had been able to see. Tell me something. When you have a big bonfire, right? You want to make a big bonfire. So you say, you know, I'm going to make a big bonfire. I have to go to Home Depot. I'm going to look in the sign section, and I'm going to get signs that say bonfire. They'll look at you like crazy. You know what the sign is for a bonfire?
The fire.
Right? But on the other hand, if you have a little wire, right? A little wire, a utility wire, or an electrified fence, and it looks like a nice regular fence, but it is as potent or more than a flaming fire. There, you get a sign, and you put it there, because it's fire, but you can't see that it's fire. So there you put up a sign, you put up a buffer zone. By a regular fire, you know what the buffer zone is? When it starts to get hot, right? When it starts to get hot, you're not going any further. The electrified fence, you go right up to it, and you won't even know that it's there, that it's electrical. You only know, Loyalena, when it's too late, right? When the sizzling sound. So the idea, asus yag la Torah. Yeah, it becomes more necessary to make fences around the Torah when it stops being visible, when it stops being clear. And that was a phenomenon that the Anshei Knesset Hagdolah were witnessing. I referred to yesterday's Haftorah, where we read about how Yeshaya told the Jewish people, you know, or Hashem told Yeshaya, excuse me, that the people, their ears will become unable to hear, their eyes will become unable to see, their hearts will become unable to understand. You'll talk to them, you'll discuss with them the problems, the issues, and they won't get it until they see, literally, this is, by the way, the word where the word Holocaust comes from, the biblical word, is in yesterday's Haftorah, Shoah, right? You know that word? That's the word, Tisho'eh, you'll see in yesterday's Haftorah. Till it's boom. Then they'll say, you know, I think we have a problem. Right? But before that, we won't recognize that we have a problem. It has to hit you between the eyes. That's an expression of a lack of the spiritual sensory powers. So of course it becomes more necessary to put up safeguards around mitzvahs when the mitzvahs are not so visible as a blazing, blazing issue, as a significant and obvious issue. So then the shmirah becomes more necessary. That's a piece to this notion of the development of safeguards within the Torah.
But we don't necessarily accept them. Like David Dover, it was a good idea, but Israel rejected it, so it fell by the wayside. How does that work?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure if Dabru Dover is an example of that, but they didn't accept it. Right. Okay. So there is a notion that sometimes the sages would look at it and say, this is an appropriate safeguard. It makes sense. It will be a good protection. Let's put it in place. But it proved too difficult for the Jewish people to accept. And so we have this tremendous idea in the Gemara that when the sages create the legislation, it requires the nation, in a certain sense, to accept the legislation. And it's a very tricky thing. It's not a normal thing. When they say it, everybody needs to do it. Right? You can't say, oh no, our vote is no. Right? You can't do that. Everybody needs to do that. But there is a post-mortem, so to speak, there is a decade after, a year after, whenever it is, test to see if this was successful in taking hold. Once upon a time, for instance, the example of the Gemara is they assert shemen shalakum, non-Jewish oil. Okay, not Saudi Arabian oil, not gasoline. We're talking about oils for cooking, you know, vegetable oils, olive oils, things like that. They assert it, just like they forbade bread under certain circumstances, just like they forbade wine, they forbade oil. But they saw that it didn't take hold. Whatever reason, it's too difficult, whatever it was, they saw that it didn't take hold. So then they said, okay, so we're going to leave that one off. And in a sense, it was repealed. It was repealed because Ein Rov HaTzibur Yecholim Lamud Bo. Yes, on some level, that's a nuance within creating these safeguards. You know, sometimes you'll put up a safeguard and you'll say, but this is absolutely, I can't do it. Right? I'm going to have a safeguard. I mean, you know, you can think of examples where you put up something there as a protection, and it was just impossible to live with. You're cutting off your nose, you know, despite your face. Just you're trying to protect something, but the method of protection is compromising, you know, the continuation of the thing itself. We can't go on like this. So that's the nuance. But again, to summarize this first piece of the second section of Maral, that he says that we have this notion of protecting the mitzvahs. But protecting the mitzvahs, protecting the gifts that God gave us, to make sure that we hold on to it, that we do it right, is primarily our responsibility. That's, Hashem says, you need to do that. You need to do that. Hashem may sometimes create for us protections, but essentially that is, once the separate entity exists, that separate entity has that survival instinct. When you talk about the fish, right, on the bottom of the sea, if I could just quickly just close that, that thing which we opened up, you know, like many things, when it comes to the theories of evolution, you know, there could be, of course, some truth to that. That survival instinct can do. Whether it is capable of making a fish change its stripes or change its skin color, you know, I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. It really doesn't have any. To me, it doesn't have any, religious connotation. It could be one of those things like the eyelid that Hashem created. Or it could be some kind of a thing, like, you know, the Gemara talks about certain peoples that maybe their eyes were a little bit more closed because they lived in sandy areas. And so they squinted. The Gemara says it that way as something which happened, which they developed. It's not heresy to talk about it doing like that. The heresy in evolution and those kinds of thinking is to say that the difference between an animal and a human being is just, you know, a graduated difference. When we say, no, there are graduated differences which exist, but that one is not a graduated difference. That is the insertion of a completely unique entity called the divine soul. Evolution can exist. Self-preservation, a survival instinct, and the ability to perhaps develop mechanisms to be able to survive could be very well one of the gifts and talents that Hashem gave human beings. But that doesn't mean that Hashem created a gob of sand and then it developed itself into an intelligent human being. Because a human being is not just intelligent. A human being is divine. A human being has that neshama that we that we talked about the first time we got together, which is not evolved, which is radical difference and radical change.
Just seems to me, if I may, you talk about the making. Why wasn't the Siyogim said as part of the original divine revelation in the Torah? It seems that we're talking about developing things over generations. If that was done, then Engel Adav Asof, because you would have, instead of 613 commandments, you would have,
right,
1800 Siyogim to go with it, and who knows what would have to develop in the future.
Right, it's objective. It's something which is going to have to develop over time. Asof Svarim Ein Kates, that's a certain degree, that's the verse at the end of Kohelis.
So is that the answer?
Huh? Yeah.